This is a Grateful Dead from 1987, Touch of Grey, which was a really poignant song, a new direction for them, and was a huge hit. Started a new chapter in the life of a band that had already been around for a couple of decades at that point. David Brown is here to talk about his new book, So Many Roads, which has been praised by critics up and down the line. And when we come back, we're going to talk about drugs and the role they played in the life of the band. Certainly took a toll in some ways, but helped put them on the map in other ways. So we'll get right to that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. David Brown, and you're in the music biz, you're the biz you cover. You have rappers who get busted for this or that. It almost seems orchestrated to give them some kind of street cred. I'm wondering if in that context, whether the bust that we were talking about before the break, at the 710, the house they lived in for the Grateful Dead, whether it elevated them, and it gave them some kind of credibility or at least attention that they didn't have before.
Well, it's funny because one of the band members did say that, back then, these were the days when, rock and roll was not still considered sort of mainstream entertainment. It wasn't really covered in the press that much. So one of the guys in the band said that, every time they did get busted or something, that their name would be in the paper, and that that would have its positive sides, that they could ask for more money for their next, the next tour, because they had that notoriety. And I hadn't really thought about it that way before, but that probably was true. It did kind of give them a little bit of outlaw kind of outsider credibility. And I don't think it was anything remotely planned. They don't think they enjoyed the experience at all. But, the thing is that none of them ever served any serious, jail time for it. I mean, the bust in 67, they basically had their wrists slapped and had paid some fines, as it were. But, it did add to the kind of aura of the band, and especially an invincible kind of aura to the band. Right after that bust in 67, I spoke to the Rolling Stone photographer, Baron Wallman, who was assigned to shoot them. And, there's a famous shot of them on the stoop of their house in Haight-Ashbury, and they're one of them's holding a rifle, another one's, flashing a middle finger. It's kind of a famous shot. And they're basically just kind of reveling in this. And the photographer, and Baron said to me, he was actually kind of afraid. He's like, it turned out the gun was like some old relic that wouldn't shoot anyway. But he was just like, oh my God, these guys are going to beat me up. They just were kind of reveling in kind of sticking it to the man, as it were. And I think that's a thread that's went throughout their whole career in a way.
They
kind of escape it.
There was a later bust in New Orleans that became pretty famous. They made a hit song out of it. Mm-hmm. It was one of their biggest hits, Truckin', right?
Right, absolutely. And they
okay. Hold on, we've lost David Brown for a second here. If you don't know the story, you could listen to the lyrics of Truckin' that they talk about being busted down on Bourbon Street. It was a similar kind of thing to the story we just heard about the bust in the Haight-Ashbury. The song Truckin' became one of their biggest hits for the Grateful Dead. I can tell you a story about personal experience with the band, how it changed things in Las Vegas in the early 90s. Grateful. I was just telling a story, David, about how the Grateful Dead came to Las Vegas for a series of concerts, annual concerts in the early 90s. I think it was 4 or maybe 5 years in a row. Changed all kinds of stuff. I mean, it changed. It was a culture clash for the Deadheads to come to Las Vegas in those days, but it changed the perception of Las Vegas within the music industry as a music venue, because it was no longer seen as just a graveyard for old crooners. And then it changed Las Vegas's attitude about rock music, rock fans, and Deadheads, to the point where people who might not have wanted that clientele realized, hey, we can make some money off all these hippies.
Absolutely. There's a famous photo, I think, of one of the casinos that says, welcome Deadheads.
Yeah.
You know, that is kind of classic. And actually, the origins of that is another chapter in my book. One of the other days I focus on was when they did a run of shows at Radio City Music Hall in 1980, and this was a similar kind of situation where, of course, now we all think of Radio City as this venerable institution, but back then it was on the it had just been on the verge of being of closing. Because it just wasn't profitable anymore, and it was almost going to be shut down and turned into a parking lot, which is staggering to think about. But they decided in 1980, one way to kind of get the place out of the hole and just get more business was, you know, booking those rock bands. And the Dead was the first actual rock and roll band. They did a whole week's worth of shows at Radio City, and there were all kinds of hilarious culture clashes there that I write about. You know, the Dead had a poster for the thing in which they had their famous skeleton icons leaning against Radio City. And right before the show started, the Rockefeller Foundation actually owned Radio City at the time, kind of freaked out. And they said, what is this poster? You're implying that the Radio City is dying because of the skeletons. And you have to, you know, you can't play the shows. You have to ban the poster. They just completely freaked out, and you know, they were saying, no, this is just the skeletons are part of our iconography. You know, it's just what we, you know, we're not saying Radio City's dying. And then later on, Radio City sued them because there were these skits during the show that implied there were drugs being used in Radio City and all that. So it was a whole tumultuous sort of week. But in the end, again, the Dead triumphed because even to this day, you know, rock and roll bands play Radio City Music Hall regularly. I go there quite often to see bands, and they, you know, they made that place kind of palatable for something other than, you know, the Rockettes. You know?
As we were talking before we lost you there for a second about the bust in New Orleans that ended up being immortalized in the song Truckin'. I mean, drugs have long been associated with the band, I mean, since the beginning, and maybe in the beginning, as you chronicle, it was kind of harmless and rebellious, smoking weed and experimenting with LSD, and then along the line, things got more serious, and these did cause some problems for the band. Talk about, in general, the progression of drug use within the band and its effects.
Well, you know, it goes hand in hand with the progression of drug use in the culture and you know, and the music business in general. By the early 70s, you know, you had harder drugs. I mean, you had cocaine kind of infiltrating everywhere. You had harder drugs, like heroin, coming in as well. And, you know, caused a lot of problems in the band, especially with Jerry Garcia. He had started to have issues with that, with the harder drugs in the late 70s. But, you know, they all kind of, you know, had their issues with that. And, you know, it caused friction between some of them, you know, along the way, and it interfered with their record making. Certainly, you know, record. You mentioned Lowell George earlier. You know, he produced Shakedown Street, and there's lots of stories in the book about, you know, how that record, you know, they were kind of more interested in all getting high together than making a great record, and that impacted on their music in a way. But yeah, they also had kind of, there was a rule in the Dead that nobody would ever criticize criticize anyone else's lifestyle as long as it didn't affect the music. So for a long time there, if one or another of them was indulging in something or that, especially Jerry, you know, no one, they kind of let it slide for a long time because it's like, you know, look, you know, he's just doing his own thing. Who are we to judge? But it did finally, by the mid 80s. Come to a head, and they started having, you know, confrontations with Jerry about his problems, and he wasn't open to that at first, and there were some very, you know, intense scenes and attempts at meetings with the band members, with him, with counselors, that did not end well. So it you know, by the 80s, what had been, you know, just sort of recreational really was impacting a lot. And in fact, one of the other chapters in the book is about their attempt to make a record in 1984 in San Francisco, a record that was never finished because you know, Jerry was not in great shape, and then some of the others weren't as well, and they just they just couldn't focus enough to actually to finish, you know, making a record, which they had done so many times before. So it really kind of came to a head by then, and you know, culminated with Jerry having was busted in 85, then he had a coma, was in a diabetic coma in 86, and you know, they started turning things around then, and almost things had to really hit rock bottom for a while there before they really got it together again with the In the Dark album.
You forget that that the Dead played at the, you know, the three biggest music events of the 60s, Woodstock, Monterey, and Altamont. Well, they were supposed to play at Altamont, but
right.
they were kind of reluctant to play at Monterey Pop. And then there was a film made about it, but they were cut out. They played at Woodstock. People forget that because they weren't in that film either. And then
right.
Altamont, they showed up, got bad vibes, justifiably so, and decided not to play and get the heck out of there. Talk about those three events in the history of the band.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a funny thing with the Dead, and one of their employees is quoted in the book is talking about that, and also includes their famous trip to Egypt in 1978, where they would show up for these high profile events, and either not play well, or something would go wrong with the equipment, or they would always kind of sort of blow it in a way. And certainly, yeah, in all those cases, you know, in Woodstock, there were electrical problems. It had rained, and there were some electrical shock problems on stage. In some of these cases too, they had to, you know, curtail their sets. They couldn't necessarily play 3 or 4 hours, and so there was that discomfort with how to organize a set, how to play it in that kind of context. But it's almost as if they, when they were put under a pressure microscope thing, it was something in them that maybe it was, again, that sort of that rebel side of them that said, you know, we're not gonna play this game. We're not gonna just do what you expect us to do or something. And so they would have these kind of big opportunities to, you know, I guess become more famous or more well known, and they would always sort of blow it in some way. Although it's funny, you look at you listen back to them now at Woodstock, where they were incredibly critical of it afterwards. So it was a terrible show. It actually doesn't seem that bad, and the same with when they played Egypt in 1978. You listen to that music now, and it's like, well, you know, it's not their best, but it's also not awful.
I mentioned some of the reviews have praised you for getting stories about the Dead that no one had ever got before. What kind of sources did you get that no one else had accessed, and what kind of stories really jumped out at you, things that you learned that were surprising that hadn't appeared anywhere else?
Boy, yeah, that's a great question. Well, see, there were, well, those recording sessions in 1984 that I mentioned, you know, I was able to get, you know, some descriptions about that from people who were there, more detailed stuff than we've seen, I think, about kind of a real kind of low point of the band. I think I learned more about Brent Midland, who was their keyboard player in the 80s. He joined in 1979 and unfortunately overdosed in 1990. And I was able to speak with, you know, people who knew him before the Grateful Dead, and, you know, one of his main girlfriends, so for example, who talked more about his life. And he was a very troubled guy even before the Grateful Dead, and how that he was an example of a survival of the fittest kind of situation, where he really tried to keep up with that lifestyle and had various issues of his own, and unfortunately cost him his life. I got access to things, you know, like a pretty hilarious document. There, when they signed a record contract in 1975 with United Artists Records, and there was like a morals clause in there, you know, if they did anything, you know, scandalous or, you know, immoral, then the deal could be called off, you know, and not a typical thing you'd see in a record contract, you know, and I tracked down their lawyer at the time, who said, yeah, you know, the record company, they'd never dealt with the Dead before, and they were a little nervous about that. And so there were things along lines like that, and you know, I got to, you know, speak to him at length to Bruce Hornsby, who played with them after Brent Midland passed away, and Bruce filled in with them for a while, and he was candid about, you know, why he briefly hooked up with the band and sort of why he also had to leave, and how, you know, Jerry's drug problems were a reason for that. He loved playing with them in some ways, but, you know, that there were musical issues there, and he also told he was also a total teetotaler, and he said, you know, he told the road crew if they ever spiked anything, you know, of his, any drink or anything, he was out, he was gone. You know, he would leave that right away. You know, kind of things like that I hadn't quite heard before. So yeah, it was. I think I came up with a good amount of information that hopefully. Even deadheads hadn't heard before.
We'll be taking a break in like 3 minutes, and then go to the phones with questions from the listeners. But let's talk about legacy stuff. What kind of legacy is there for the band? You mentioned about social networking, effects on social networking, about effects on indie labels, and I guess a topic of great interest to people in your line of work, what's happened to the record industry, what the Grateful Dead... Right. And that experience is meant to that stuff.
Right. I mean, the whole idea of just going right to the fans and having that kind of direct connection that you see now in Twitter and Facebook, pretty common. That really, you know, the Dead really in a way started that. They even back with a newsletter that they would send to fans back in the early 70s. And, you know, I spoke with fans back then who would talk to me with kind of amazement that, you know, you would sign up on the inner sleeve of the Grateful Dead live album in 71 and said, hey, send us your address and we'll keep you posted. And they would do this, and you would get this occasional newsletter from the band in the mail with, you know, hey, here's what we're doing, here's what we're up to, blah, blah, blah. And they're pretty amazing documents. I mean, it really is like early social media. And as far as, yes, an indie label kind of thing, you know, their attempt at a record indie label, Grateful Dead Records, didn't last more than 2 years. But, you know, that really laid the foundation for this idea that, you know, maybe you can operate outside the system, and it took decades for that to really kick in and for the music business as we know it to kind of start crumbling. But, you know, I think the Dead in their way saw that. And of course, hilariously, their first idea for their own record company was to distribute their records through ice cream trucks.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it was kind of a good humor thing where they would have like a coupon, and this whole system didn't quite implement that. But, you know, and kind of typically wacky Grateful Dead way of approaching that. But, yeah, they've left kind of a huge legacy, and it's even not just those fans who are still out there who go see the offshoot Grateful Dead bands like Further and so forth, but also in a business, like in the business way, in the social media way, and in the music way. I mean, the way, again, they blended all these different kinds of music, rock and roll, jazz, blues, country, you name it, in a way that, you know, other bands have emulated, and the Dead, and no one quite did that before they did.
All right, the reunion concert, supposedly the final concert for the remaining members, coming up in July. Whether or not it's the real end or not, I'll ask you your opinion on that, and then we'll take in phone calls from our listeners. Bruce Hornsby, just mentioned a minute ago, takes us into the break with one of his best songs, The Way It Is. 50 years of The Grateful Dead comes to an end in July in Chicago, and... I'm going to find out if David Brown plans to be there. He's written this great book about the band, So Many Roads, and we're going to open up the phone lines with your questions for David about the band and the book right after this on Coast to Coast AM. David, tell me about Chicago. I guess it's sold out already. Is it one show, multiple shows? Do you plan to be there?
It's going to be three shows in Chicago, and then there are going to be two shows preceding that were just announced in California. And they are sold out. They have an unprecedented demand for tickets for this three Chicago shows when they were announced, which was one reason they added earlier ones in Chicago, in California, in late June. And, you know, I think it was hundreds of thousands of people tried to get tickets for that, I think to the point where I think it surprised everybody, including the promoter of the shows. I mean, they didn't quite anticipate the enormous demand to see the four surviving members, core members, playing together again. And I think that's because they have announced, the shows are called Fare Thee Well, and they're saying this will be the last time they play together. I think they'll continue to play with their own bands and so forth, but they've made it pretty clear that, you know, this is it. If you want to see us together again, playing these songs with Bruce Hornsby and Trey Anastasio from Phish also joining them, this is it. And I do plan to be there. Hopefully I'll have a book signing event around that time in Chicago, details being worked out. But it's becoming quite an event, you know, in a way that I think as you know, it kind of affirms the legacy of the band, but also I think took a lot of people by surprise that there would still be such a huge demand.
So why isn't it a farewell tour instead of just a couple of shows?
You know, I'm not completely sure. I think they just wanted to they decided to do a couple of shows together. And then they picked Chicago because they thought it'd be, you know, kind of the perfect for the middle of the country. But of course, they've changed their mind and added California. I think they just decided, you know, kind of keep it kind of short and sweet and not kind of drag it out. Which, you know, I think there's some value to that. There, you know, a lot of the rock history is dotted with stories of reunion tours that, you know, start out pretty well, and by the end, musicians are pretty sick of each other.
Yeah.
maybe this is a smart way of doing that. You know.
Can you call it the Grateful Dead without Jerry Garcia?
Well, you know, when he died, they had a meeting right afterwards, and they decided right away that they were never going to be the Grateful Dead again. And they were, and for years after that, they used different names. They were the Other Ones for a while. they were just the Dead for a few tours there. And you know, I think this is probably the exception. I mean, I guess they are back to calling the posters say, you know, a celebration of music of the Grateful Dead or something. So they are using Grateful again for the first time since Jerry died, and I guess this is the one exception they'll make for it. I mean, you almost have to, in this case, use that term.
Sure.
You can't just say the Dead, because I think these concerts are a reunion and a kind of a, you know, summation of what they've done. So I think in this case, you know, they're kind of justified in using the word Grateful again for the first time in 20 years.
Well, I agree with you. Let's take a couple of calls. Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hi, Frank. You're on with David Brown.
Howdy, guys. Glad to be with you. David, I'd like for you to verify something for me. Did Jerry do a session job with the Chills and Nash on the great song Teach Your Children, written by Graham Nash? Because when I went to the the Chills and Nash concerts, Stephen Stills played the guitar just like Jerry's steel guitar. And, of course, I think he used the that new invention called the B-Bender that the late Clarence White invented. What a guitar player he was. So do you know anything about that?
Yeah, that is absolutely Jerry playing pedal steel guitar on the original studio version of Teach Your Children. He had just gotten that instrument and played it with the new Riders of the Purple Sage, as George mentioned earlier. And so he's absolutely on that record. They were all hanging around that album, Deja Vu, was recorded in San Francisco at a studio called Wally Hyder's that the Grateful Dead were using occasionally themselves. It was a very you know, convivial kind of incestuous atmosphere back then among all those musicians. And you know, later that year, Jerry's also on David Crosby's album, If I Could Only Remember My Name, doing some great stuff on there as well.
Because that steel guitar, I was brought up in rhythm and blues, being a young black guy in high school. But then when Mr. Tambourine Man came out, that one song of the century in my mind. Then later on, when they folk rock thing came about. That steel guitar, that twang, it got into my system, and it's been there ever since.
Well, it's good stuff, Frank. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. We're going to go to John in Long Beach, California. Hi, John. You're on with David Brown.
It's good to talk to you again. I got to tell you real quick, I'm a newspaper guy. I write headlines, you know, and I was working at a paper, and Jerry Garcia died. I had a reputation for writing sassy headlines, and I almost got this headline in. The headline was "Head Dead." But they, at the last minute, they didn't run it.
Wow!
But that's pretty good. But anyway, I wanted to ask you. You know, I saw the Dead 3 or 4 times. One of Irvine Meadows out here, and you know, I saw on Tom Snyder one time. They had Garcia and Bob Weir. Two questions: how close were Bob Weir and Jerry Garcia? They came from totally different backgrounds, and I guess he said at that time, I seem to remember, he was like 17 when he joined the band. Might have still just been maybe even in high school, if I have that right. And also, what did the death of Pigpen, Ron McKernan, I think his last name was, when he died in 1973, what impact did that have on the band? Those guys were pretty close to each other, right? And he was with Biker's friends and things, but they were all close, and that had a big devastating effect on them, didn't it, at the time?
Yeah, it did. I mean, the answer to that, absolutely. I mean, you know, Pigpen died, he was 27, and he'd been having health issues for many years before that, but it was a pretty devastating thing to that scene. It was the first, I think, sign to a lot of them of, you know,
mortality,
and, you know, the lifestyle can catch up with you, at that point. So that, you know, and you know, Jerry even said to someone right after that, you know, maybe they're not even the Grateful Dead anymore at that point, which, you know, to those of us who follow the band seems kind of crazy because they, you know, they had such a great period for a few more years after that, but it had a huge effect. And as far as, you know, Bob and Jerry were, they had this sort of, you know, big brother, little brother kind of bond. You're absolutely right. I mean, they came from different backgrounds. I mean, Bob Weir was from Atherton, this kind of, you know, upper-class suburb, and Jerry was more of a street kid, you know. But I think I think Bob, you know, really looked up to Jerry as a kind of a the cool big brother figure, and I think Jerry was in a way very protective of Bob, in a way, and you know, even early on promising his parents he'd bring him home after rehearsals, whether or not he actually did or not. But and I always thought that relationship, you know, musically too, was one of the things that always appealed to me about the Dead. That, I mean, I've always been someone who loves bands that don't just have one lead singer, you know, whether it was the Beatles or Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. I like groups with different lead singers, and I think Jerry and Bob each had, you know, different voices, different types of songs they sang, different approaches. I thought that added to the breadth of the band as well.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Good questions. We're going to Joe in the Bronx. Hi, Joe. You're on with David Brown.
Hi. How are you, George?
I wanted
to ask David Brown about the Warlocks, who eventually became the Grateful Dead. And I know Jerry Garcia was originally a bluegrass guitarist. Are there any recordings that were made by the Warlocks? They played acid parties in California that still survive. And also,
Go ahead.
And also, what bands were the Grateful Dead influenced by?
Oh boy. Well, as far as the Warlocks, the closest we came. It's a great question about recordings. In fact, one of the chapters in my book is devoted to one of the nights they played a pizza parlor at the very beginning of the Warlocks in May of 1965, right when Phil Lesh joined them. That was a really pivotal moment when Phil joined the band, because he brought his he was not a conventional bass player, and he had a whole different take on music. He came from a classical background. He brought a whole thing to them, and that was a really important night for them. And I asked around, like, does anybody have tapes of the Warlocks at that pizza parlor? And, like, you know, even their archivist, who has been Dave Lemire, who's a great guy and very helpful to me, doesn't know of any of the recordings. The closest we've come to that is a few months later, they did some recordings in a studio of some early songs right as they were about to change their name to the Grateful Dead, or right in that period. So, you know, they were almost not the Warlocks anymore. So unfortunately, you know, when they were playing with the Warlocks in that spring, summer of 65, early fall, playing, you know, just bars and, you know, really, you know, dive bar kind of places and so forth, no one was recording them, unfortunately. At least not that anyone, including the Dez archivist, has come across, which is unfortunate. As far as their influences, boy, I mean, they're all over the place, you know, from you know, Jerry growing up with hearing country and early rock and roll, and like I said, Phil Lesh, classical music, you know, Bob Weir was a folky, you know, Pigpen was into just, you know, his dad was a legendary DJ who specialized in R&B and blues, and so, you know, Pigpen brought that to them. They all loved jug band music early on. You know, kind of an astonishing array of music they all brought. Bill Kreutzmann, the drummer, was a jazz guy. And you can hear all that. I mean, you know, that's what's sort of fascinating. Each guy in the Dead is such a distinct personality. And they also had very distinct musical tastes that they brought to each other. And they all kind of learned to play electric instruments like together, you know, in that band. They all were, a lot of them were acoustic players. So it's really, it's kind of amazing it all worked. You know, when you think about it, different guys, different backgrounds, different music, it shouldn't have worked, but it did.
I should mention that the book, So Many Roads, has the complete sort of bios, history of each of these band members and how they came to be in the band. And, David, there's some terrific photos. That early shot you have of Jerry Garcia, I would never have picked him out of a lineup.
Right. That's probably the one, yeah, where he's in 1961 looking like a typical kind of beatnik, you know, goatee beatnik kind of guy.
Yeah, with Robert Hunter, is it? A shot with Robert Hunter, I think.
Yeah, it's a great photo. It's a great rare photo over there.
There's a lot of great photos. Thanks for the call there,
Thank
Joe.
You.
We're going to go to west of the Rockies, Rich in San Francisco. Hi, you're on with David.
Hey, great show, guys. See, I saw the Dead from 72 to 82 probably 100 times. I did see the movie out here in Winterland. I was fortunate. I'm from the East Coast, but I was out here. And when I can't, well, first of all, why Chicago and not here? That just seems crazy, but forget that. In 68, the first time they left the Bay Area was the Quick and the Dead tour. And John Cipollina and Jerry Garcia are the two most psychedelic guitarists of all time, especially Cipollina. And Jerry said at his memorial, what can I say, that Cipollina's sound is embedded in my DNA. It's I can't locate in Wolfgang's vault, the spoken lead, all these shows they did, Lake Tahoe, Ashland, Oregon, Seattle, famous shows in Seattle, the Eagles Club or something. Did anyone ever hear that? I always wanted to hear Jerry on stage with Cipollina. Not in 82, in 68, the height of the whole acid era. You know anything about that?
I haven't heard anything about that.
Hello?
Hey, Rich, we're gonna let David answer. Rich, hold on a second. David?
I haven't heard that myself. I'm going to make a note of that, though, and try to see if that's around. I'm not, I'll have to investigate that, the 68 shows with them together. Because that was a period where they were, sometimes they were recording their shows every night and sometimes not. They had, that whole process hadn't completely kicked in. They weren't at that time, I don't think, working much with Owsley, their sound guy. He was sort of out of the picture, so he wasn't recording every show. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, Cipollina was amazing, and Quicksilver, you know, I think most people maybe know them from, you know, Fresh Air. What About Me? You know, like two songs, but you know they were as important a band back then, almost as the Dead, and it's kind of a shame that they're kind of almost forgotten unless you're a real expert on that scene.
Yeah, Quicksilver, Moby Grape, that was a great music scene back then. Thank you, Rich, for the call. John in San Rafael, California, on the Wild Card Line. Hi, John. You're on with David Brown.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I have a two-part question for guests. I know we don't have a whole lot of time.
That's right.
But, I live directly across the street. I live in San Anselmo, and I live directly across the street from a Chinese acupuncture clinic in San Anselmo that I was told that Gary Garcia used to attend before his passing. So I was wondering if your guest knew anything about that. And part two of the question is, I go to 900 Front Street frequently to see the Grateful Dead's rehearsal space that was going on through the 70s, 80s, and early part of the 90s. And in Bob Dylan's autobiography, he talks about not being sure about whether or not he wanted to tour with the Grateful Dead, and walked to a bar and had a revelation in a bar. And I think I found a bar, and it's called Pier 15. I was wondering if your guest knew anything about the Bob Dylan Grateful Dead connection to Pier 15 bar in San Rafael.
Well, let's find out.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, John.
Yeah. I've heard about the acupuncturist because, well, when Jerry collapsed in 92, he had a whole health regimen that involved all kinds of kind of new age healing things and so forth. He didn't go into any kind of official rehab back then. He just kind of did it all at home and did it locally. And that might be the person you're referring to. I think that was maybe 92, 93, died 95. So that kind of makes sense to me. The bar story with Dylan, I've read that Dylan book as well, and I mentioned that. I didn't track down that exact bar. I did hear lots of great stories about Dylan at Front Street when they were rehearsing for that tour in 87, and you know how they nicknamed him, because there was already a Bob Weir in the Grateful Dead, so nobody wanted to call him Bob, so they just started calling him Spike just as a joke, and he actually liked that. He thought it was kind of funny that people weren't taking him seriously, and I guess he was there when they finished the Touch of Grey video, and the director told me that he brought it in to Front Street to show the band the finished thing, you know, with the skeletons and all that. And Dylan was just sitting there quietly in the back, like watching this, you know, and everyone wasn't sure, you know, how we go over, and as soon as it was over, you know, Jerry just loved the video, and as long as Jerry liked it, everyone else was happy. Everyone's like, great, and Dylan didn't say anything, but just quietly shook the director's hand. Like, that was his nod of approval, you know. The director,
David,
okay.
Dave, I want to thank you for being on the show. Wish you all the luck in the world with the book. It's an great fun and a great read, and I'm glad you were here with us again.
Great, thanks, George. Well,
all right.
Great to be here.
Yeah, well, anytime. Let me know what you're up to.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks to our guest David Brown and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Tricia Pepe and Nathan Staten, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, and our producer Chris Boros. And I'll be back next Sunday night. Hope you can tune in then. Good night, everyone.